Hello and welcome to the Overland Journal podcast. I am your host, Scott Brady, and I am joined today by one of my heroes, Kingsley Holgate. Now, Kingsley and the Kingsley Holgate Foundation have done incredible work, incredible expeditions, not only around the world, but throughout Africa. They have taken an expedition to the geographic center of Africa, never been done before. They circumnavigated Africa as close to the coastline as they could do, which is something that was a first with Land Rovers. And they also did a circumnavigation of the globe on the Tropic of Capricorn. Kingsley and his team are incredibly inspirational. They provide support to millions of people in Africa. They have provided over 2 million nets to help protect children and young adults from the infection of malaria. They also have done incredible work around the Right for Sight. They've provided over 200,000 reading glasses to the peoples of Africa that have given sometimes the first ability to read in many, many years or to see clearly to do their work. Like working on shoes was one example that he gave. Kingsley is an incredible individual. And one of the things that I find most inspiring about his story is that he didn't start any of this until he was over 50 years old. So it's a reminder that life is never, you're never past your prime. Kingsley is doing things that are absolutely incredible in his 70s. And that is a wonderful reminder to me. It should be a wonderful reminder to all of you that you don't need to be in your 20s to start these grand expeditions. You can be in the later half of life and have an impact far greater than can ever be imagined. So please enjoy this wonderful conversation with Kingsley Holgate.
And a special thanks to Real Truck for their support of this week's podcast. Find your freedom and follow your own trail into the fresh air of vast, uncharted places. Introducing the exclusive Real Truck lineup of overlanding accessories designed to take adventurous explorers just like you into the furthest reaches with gear for camping, off-roading, and more, including the all-new Real Truck Go Rack, Go Tent, and Overland Awning. And here's to those inspired, self-actualized souls brave enough to unplug and check into pure wilderness. Bring your truck to life at realtruck.com. Thanks again, Real Truck.
So, Kingsley, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It is an incredible honor for me to not only have this conversation with you, but to be sitting with you in your beautiful home on the continent that you so love and have traveled so extensively. And I don't even know that it's possible for us to cover your life in 100 podcasts. So we're going to do our best to at least help people understand who you are and the good that you've done in Africa, how you've given back, and that some of the highlights of a few of the journeys that you've done. Because as I understand it, it's 40 expeditions over 30 years. So you're another one of those gentlemen who have forgotten more than I'll ever learn. So it's an honor for me to be here with you today. So, thank you, Kingsley.
Likewise, Scott. What a pleasure to have you here at Africa House, as we call it, surrounded by all this memorabilia from so many journeys.
Yes.
On the Indian Ocean, here at a place called Sinkwazi, place of the fish eagle. And, yeah. Of course, I think you can hear the sound of the ocean in the background.
I can. It's a beautiful view that I'm looking out on right now. So
when we're not on expedition, this is where we come to relax and spread out some old paper maps and dream of the next journey.
We talked about that a little bit earlier when we were having some watermelon. We talked about the realities of returning from a trip, and you had a very clever insight of that a certain percentage of the time that you were away you should dedicate to assimilating the experience. Talk a little bit about why you do that.
Yes, it's interesting, you know, if you divide, let's call a journey 100%, and so how much time do you give to the research before you go and getting embedded into the story? And then how much time should you spend on the actual journey? Yeah. And then something we tend to forget about, you know, what about when you get back to sort of reliving the journey so that you don't lose it? Yeah. Going through your notes, looking at the maps again, and treasuring those moments. And I think we were just joking early on. We said it could be as much as 20% that you give to sort of reliving the journey so that it remains with you, going through the scrolls, going through your notebooks, before you sort of launch into the next one. And by the way, that's sometimes a bit of a luxury. You don't always have the time.
Yeah.
But how lovely if you can reminisce, sit with a team around a fire afterwards and say, how was it, you know, and think back.
And that might be part of why people struggle after a trip with reassimilating into life, is that they haven't given it that moment to fully integrate and to spend time with their team and to really make those memories stronger.
It can be a difficult time. You know, when you're given, I'm thinking of some of our longer journeys, tracking the outline of Africa, for example, that took 449 days dedicated to tracking the edge.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get back from that and you just got so much to think about.
So about how long have you taken on average, do you think, after some of your journeys to reflect?
Sometimes not enough immediately, and then you tend to reflect a lot later. So always it's a bit of a luxury to get back. Maybe don't tell everybody you're home yet. Mm. You know, just sneak in, kick off your shoes, you know, get into a soft bed, clean sheets.
That can be pretty nice.
Yeah, not sleeping in your tent, but yes, that time to reflect.
Yeah.
And, you know, a week, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But just to sit with all your notes and think back while they're still fresh in your mind and think about all the stories and the people you met. And then by having notebooks and a scroll and recording everything, I mean, if you think of that old early Scottish explorer, Dr. David Livingstone, why was he different to others? Well, it was because he took so much effort to record things, little maps, little notebooks, and that's why his journeys live on today. And so we try, it's a discipline, but you know, every morning, take out the notebook, scribble the details of last night and what happened, who you met, people's names, and a little sketch down the margin. And, you know, this house has got literally hundreds of notebooks scattered about. We try and keep them in one old box. But that's also part of the sort of reminiscing and thinking back of the journey. So it's great. And I think you go out, you know, I remember once traveling the Tropic of Capricorn around the world. 23 degrees 27. And I remember crossing Australia, the widest part of Australia,
sure,
and meeting a delightful old Aboriginal. And instead of him asking me my name or what we were doing, he said, "So what's your story, mate?" And it's always stuck with me, is, you know, amongst many African peoples, your life is more about the story. The story of your life. What's your story? Why are you doing it? Who are you? You know, why are you doing this challenging journey? So I think that's the African way. It's about sharing a story around the campfire, these old notes, these reminiscing. And I think it's something that maybe we're missing, aren't we, in this modern age, you know,
is
I think people are so caught up in mobile phones and social media and everything that the art of storytelling around the campfire, you know, the old raised enamel mug, and it's story time. I mean, I always love it when people say, explain some of your journey, and I say, well, you know, so much of it is those stories around the campfire, getting into camp just before dark, loading a bit of firewood as you go, and you know, the sparks flying into the night sky and starlit sky, and you know, pouring your favorite tipple into your old enamel mug, and that's when the story started. You know, you hear an old black maned lion roaring in the distance, the cry of a jackal, the hysterical cackle of a hyena, and it's story time. And you've got that old cast iron pot on the fire, this old three-legged pot, you know, and it's sort of bubbling away with your favorite stew. And I think that's such a special time in Africa, in the wilderness, surrounded by nature, and those times, shared moments around the campfire. Now maybe in our discussions here, this podcast, right, is maybe it's really just a campfire story.
It is, and oftentimes they feel that way because we have a chance to look back, and also the opportunity to really think about the origin for a lot of this. And that leads me to my next question, which is, as I understand it, you were born into a missionary family. Now, where were you born in the world? Where were you actually first born?
I was born here in Zululand, north of the Tugela River, and I was the youngest of three boys, and born of a missionary family and teachers, and my mum and dad would take us all over Africa. And so at a very early age, you know, we got to know about flooded rivers and strange tribes, and always the purpose of these journeys, however, was to do good. And yeah, my dad was a missionary teacher, and he just spent his life doing good. And I suppose maybe that that, you know, had an effect on us, that these journeys that we do should not just be purely for the sake of the journey. You know, that can be quite egotistical, can't it?
I agree.
You've got this great big 4x4, you've got the right tires, you've got the right roof rack, you've got all this stuff. But I think, you know, to go into these journeys with a sense of humility, realizing just how privileged you are to be able to do these journeys and use all that energy, the vehicles, the tents, the equipment, the team, the goodwill, but use them to improve and save the lives of others as best you can as part of the adventure. So that's very much become the mission or the yardstick of our journeys, is to use these adventures. Some of them are world first, some have never been done before, and they're great, and always the adventure's phenomenal. And you know, they come with all the dangers. You know, I don't know how many times I've had malaria. I think it's 60 times now.
Is it 60? I was gonna ask you about that.
You know, and sometimes you end up in sort of warlike situations, you know, child soldiers and stuff. But always just to remember how privileged you are to be living this life in Africa, a continent that we so love, cradle of all humankind, a very special place for us. And then to use the energy of these journeys to spread goodwill, to spread love and hope, and to help others. Yeah. And that side of our journey sometimes can be more than 50%.
That time that you spent with your dad, I know, was really important to you. And you learned, like you just said, about giving back. But what were some of the other things that you learned from your dad that you remember?
Well, storytelling.
Yeah.
But also the realization that a lot can be sorted out with humor. The danger of taking yourself too seriously.
Yeah, that's certainly a danger.
You know, Africa loves a laugh.
Yeah.
And Africans love a laugh. And so, you know, if you can poke fun at yourself and not say, whoa, I'm on this journey and it's so tough, but rather just laugh at us. You know, we are these idiots that are trying to go around the world on the Tropic of Capricorn. And I think that's something that I did learn, that there was always this wonderful sense of humor and camaraderie and not taking yourself too seriously. And I'm really proud to say that in all these journeys, and this is number 41 actually, but is as long as they've been, and I think the longest one is 449 days, a single journey, and there have been some longer ones, I think, but the team has always stood together. You've always known that they've got your back.
Yeah.
And you always know that sometimes in very difficult surroundings, you're okay because of the strength of the team. And that's been, I think, particularly easy for us because by and large, we've traveled as a family.
Yeah, and you've traveled a lot with your son.
Yes, and my son Ross, who's now just over 50, but he started as a real youngster, sitting around the fire, the stories, everything. And I remember he was studying at the time. He'd left college and he would come home for the weekend and he'd see us sitting with all the maps and everything. At that time, we were planning a journey from Cape Town to Cairo and Alexandria on all the rivers and lakes of Africa in inflatable boats, open boats. And you know, when you look it up, you can't believe how they're all interconnected.
They really
these
are.
These beautiful Rift Valley lakes and rivers and everything. And I could see he was thinking deeply, and then one day he simply couldn't hold himself back. He said, I have to be part of this journey. You know, I have to be part of it. And along he came, and just, you know, he cut his teeth on this magnificent journey across Africa that was tough in those days. And here he is also living the same life. And in fact, today he does all the logistics. He's expedition leader on most of the expedition, if not all. And it's so lovely that as a family, we've been able to take this tradition. When recently we traveled with my grandkids, the two granddaughters. It was fantastic. You know, the wildlife, the tribes, everything. That they too could become entrenched in this way of life, which, as I say, is such a privilege. And every indication is that they will be that way. They'll like it.
And what are you most proud of your son?
You know, we came out of a South Africa that had terrible politics. You know, the apartheid era. Not that we ever practiced it, because we lived in the bush and our best friends were the Zulus.
Yeah.
You would go to traditional weddings and everything. You know, apartheid, we sort of hardly knew about it.
You were disconnected from it.
Disconnected about it. But still, I'm so delighted to see in my son his knowledge of African languages, his rapport with African people. And I once we were sitting and discussing a new pilgrim of adventure that wanted to join us on a mission, and it was a particularly tough one. It was to follow the Rufiji River in the footsteps of Frederick Courtney Salu, considered the greatest outdoors man of his time. So a lot of wildlife, a lot of crocodiles, lots of hippos in boats, everything. And this youngster wanted to join us. Delightful young man. And we had the interview right here at Africa House. We sat here and at the Explorer's Bar. And the first question I said to him, I said, "Hey, Bruce, can you sit around a campfire only with Africans? You, as the only white South African. And can you eat out of the same pot and share the conversation in their language? And are you relaxed with that? Because if you can't, there's no space for you in this expedition." And he replied by saying, "I do it every week. I meet with my Zulu neighbors. We share a pot. We go into the bush together. I speak good Zulu." And African. Well, he came on that one expedition and lost it for 15 years. He never left.
You know, one of the things that I just found out about today is these books that you have, these scrolls.
Yes.
And I was really taken back by it, Kingsley, because I've never seen anything like that. I have definitely seen volumes that speak to the adventure and maybe the ego, right? Whereas these scrolls, talk a little bit about what inspired you to do them and how do they work?
So, I'm not sure how it started, but I think it's because we like writing, and we like writing by hand. A bit old-fashioned, I know. I don't have a laptop. But, you know, sitting sunrise under the veranda of your tent under the canvas, old camp table, canvas chair, take out your book, take your pencil, your pen, and write the notes of the previous day's journey. And, you know, once it becomes a habit, it's really quite fulfilling, and it's a type of discipline. So you know that writing is important, and maybe that's how it started. We then thought every expedition should have its own book, its own journal, so to speak. And then
they're massive. They're beautiful. They're beautiful.
They're huge. And then we approached a good friend of ours, Rob Melville from Melville and Moon, and they do beautiful handcrafted canvas stuff, you know, safari luggage and all that. We said, "Couldn't you make us a big book for each journey, 200 pages, beautifully bound, leather and canvas in the corners and old print, and we'd carry these in a specific canvas bag, and we could call them, let's call them Scrolls of Peace and Goodwill." And I so remember that this, so the tradition started. We would carry this. I suppose it was something like a visitor's book.
Sure.
So I would meet you somewhere in some strange place, as I hope we will in the near future.
We've almost done that a few times.
Yes. And I say, "Yeah, Scott, won't you just scribble something in this scroll?" And you'd say to me, "So what should I scroll?" I say, something about the importance of peace and goodwill. And of course, you know, if you look at world affairs at the moment, peace and goodwill, I think, is
in short supply,
a high priority. Yeah. So people would scribble and people would draw, and then kids. So we'd meet kids who'd be fascinated by the adventure, talk to them around the campfire, or go to their school and talk about wildlife and conservation, and they'd put their little handprint. And then, you know, you trace the handprint into the pages of the scroll of peace and goodwill. Maybe you would be doing malaria work with in Samburu land in northern Kenya, and there would be these Samburu ladies in their beautiful beaded finery, jewelry, and their red ochre bodies. They rub red ochre on their skins, and they would simply take their hands, rub their bodies, red ochre, and they put a red ochre handprint into the scroll of peace and goodwill. And so these books became an important part of each and every expedition. I remember, and that must have been just after that great man, Nelson Mandela, had been released from prison and a wind of positive change was blowing across our country, and going to see Nelson Mandela and him giving us some of his precious time, and with us sitting with him as a family, and then him opening the scroll. And I remember what that journey was. It was to track the entire outline of Africa. Yeah. And in his strong hand, he wrote, "Thank you for supporting the people of Africa and for caring for the mothers and children as you travel." And then he signed it. And you know, that picture of us sitting with Madiba and his message in that scroll, in a way, became more important than a passport. And so we still have that picture, we still have that scroll. Yeah. And so these scrolls of peace and goodwill, which are really, as I say, just big books, became such an important part of every journey. And the journey that we're on now is all about community, conservation and culture. Yeah. And it's to work with communities alongside areas of wildlife protection, letting them know how valued neighbors they are, how important good neighborliness is.
Yeah, sure.
And helping with malaria work and right to sight, the provision of spectacles to poor-sighted people, reading all that good stuff. And they too scribble in the scroll. You know, it's quite life. So, and then years later, when you go through those scrolls, you see who you met, and it's great.
It was really a beautiful thing to look at. Photos. You know, there's an introduction in the book about what you're doing and what the goals are. Those are things probably you do before you leave. But it definitely made me think about how all of us as travelers could benefit from something like that, of making sure that we write down the name of the person that we meet, that we even draw what we experienced. I think it helps us codify those memories. I think it helps us remember those experiences more than just a cell phone photo.
I know how easy the cell phone is, and it takes a picture, go on to notes. Yeah. And yet, you know, that old written word and the sketches, yeah, it is the old way of adventurous, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, that's what we do.
No, I feel a bit of guilt in the fact that I wrote my notes and questions on an iPad. No, but it's true, though, and it's good to be challenged. I think it's so important to be challenged. The first time that I met you, when I listened to your talk in South Africa, and you talked about the importance of giving back, it helped me begin to reframe my own adventures, because I definitely see how my ego needed to be checked, and I needed to remember that I'm so fortunate to do what I do. But it's those kinds of challenges that we need in our life, Kingsley. So I appreciate you saying that, and I appreciate this idea of, you know, this hope, peace and hope and goodwill, and a way to record people's experiences. That's really beautiful.
Because, as you know, you could have volumes of doom and gloom,
yeah,
if you decided to take that path of negativity.
Right.
And on expedition, while sitting around the fire, sometimes if somebody gets a bit doom and gloomish,
yeah,
we quickly say, shh, expeditions are all about positivity. And yes, you can have the end goal in sight, but it's about living the day to day, one bite at a time, small bites. If we can get over today, if we can cross that river, if we can get over that mountain, if we can get through this area, live it for that, and then the final challenge will suddenly be there. You know, you would have made it, but you know from your travels the importance of bite sizes.
Being in the moment, yeah.
Being in the moment, bite sizes, if we can do that, we can get there. And I think that's... Someone once asked me, what do you feel is one is a key ingredient to becoming an expedition member? What character traits would one look for? And I think the expectation was that I would say, well, obviously fit, tough, able to face challenges and live a tough life. And I think they might have been surprised when I said the most important thing, curiosity. Because if you're not curious, if you don't really want to know what happens in that village or around the corner or over that mountain or up the river, and if you're not curious, and it's just, oh, it's just another journey and I'm doing it for the sake of, well, I did the journey. And right. And if you're not curious about the tribes, the languages, the cultures, then I think it takes away from the journey. So, because I think the rest you can learn, can't you?
I do like that framing. One of the things that we always look for is kindness in someone. So if someone is kind and curious, you're probably 90% there.
Better still, the kindness and the consideration for others.
Yes, that's right.
That sense of humor we talk about, so important, isn't it?
Which I think is a form of kindness. I mean, to be able to laugh at yourself and to tell a joke and not take yourself so seriously.
I mean, you know from your journeys how really things can go wrong some days. And you can either laugh about it and smile or you can cry. And there are tough times, and there are times when your lives are threatened even.
Yeah.
But to be able to laugh at it and to enjoy the moment, after, sometimes only afterwards. But yes.
When you finally get to take a breath,
That's, I think, sense of humor, a sense of curiosity, kindness, and forget the negativity. This positive thinking, yes, we can do it.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes it might even be a bit unreal. You know, really, can you do it? But you say, we can do this. I'm sure we can do it. And I know that adventures are all about being at the right place at the right time, seizing the moment. Yes, that country's at peace. We can cross it now.
Yeah.
And not saying, we'll revisit that problem next year. Now is the opportunity.
Yeah.
And be able to move quickly, pack your bag and go. And so, I think that's where Africa is quite a fascinating place. You know, all good, all bad, all at the same time.
Yes.
But if your motivation is always to seek the good, well, that's a bit easier, isn't it?
And the goodness of the people of Africa has been evident at every junction that I've ever had in this continent.
And a special thanks to Winnebago for their support of this week's podcast. Can you hear that? Backcountry adventures are calling. Let the new Winnebago Revel take you there. It's the ultimate adventure-ready van built on an all-wheel drive Mercedes-Benz Sprinter and comes fully loaded with a turbo diesel engine, robust gear storage, new off-road lighting, and an innovative off-grid PowerMax system. Plus, more optional upgrades to customize it to your needs. Stay wild. Stay longer. To learn more about the all-new Revel, visit winnebago.com. Thanks, Winnebago.
Wonderful word, Ubuntu. You know, we only are who we are through others.
Yeah.
And so when we are sitting around that pot and everyone sharing a few pieces of meat and some maize meal porridge, eating with your forefingers and hands and that camaraderie, that sense of Ubuntu, we are who we are only through other people. And I think that guides us. And I also think that I remember that day sitting with Nelson Mandela and him writing those words in the Scroll of Peace and Goodwill has also steered us. It's sort of been a mentorship that we should stay true to our cause by of using these journeys to improve and save the lives of others. And just to hopefully try and create a bit of a better world, the little bit that we can. And I know we are but a grain of sand in the greater sphere of things, but it does give the journey's purpose. And you know, we carry this. It's an old Zulu talking stick. In Zulu it's called Induzo Pefumula. That translated into English would be the stick that gives you the power to breathe words.
Okay.
And this stick goes back to the time of Isandlwana, the Anglo-Zulu Wars of 1879, and it lives behind the Land Rover seat. And when we meet a local chief or just others, out comes the the Induzo Pepamula, the stick that gives you the power to read words, and that is shared around the campfire. Yeah. And you know, I've seen it. Someone takes hold of the stick. I say, can you feel it? And sometimes a person is shy, and all of a sudden they're able to speak and share their thoughts. So that is one of the many traditions that we have to our journeys, is carrying the old talking stick. Have I told you about the caliber?
No, you haven't, but I think we've got it right here.
So this is another sort of a bit of African symbolism. So this is called an ikula in Zulu, and it's just a decorated traditional calabash. Calabashes such as these are used for beer, for carrying water, for carrying sour milk. But in this case, for the start of every journey, the calabash is filled with water and then emptied symbolically at the end. And on other expeditions, it gathers water from key places all along the journey. For example, when we did the Great African Rift Valley all the way from the Gulf of Tjora near Djibouti, following the Rift Valley or the East and Western Rifts all the way down to Lake Urima in Gorongosa in Mozambique, we collected bits of water from every water source. It was a bit of a ceremony. Wow. People would look at us and say, I wonder what those strange people are doing with a decorated calabash. And then at the end of the journey, emptying it out into Lake Urima. And then on this journey that we're involved in now, with African Parks, it's to connect all their conservation areas across Africa in 12 countries, more than 20 million hectares under protection, but to work with their communities. Yeah. And we should talk about
I would like to. Yeah, it's so evident that not only have you been able to have these incredible adventures and journeys, but you have found a way to give back through each one of those processes, and it's just really impressive to me. So,
and it's fun. But just to finish off with the calabash, is on this journey, for example, at every wildlife area we get to, every conservation area we go to, the head of the park and say, where would you like to add a smidgen of water to the calabash? And he sits and he says, well, you know, I would like to go to that very secretive little water hole, which was a favorite place that black rhinos used to come and drink at. But now they've all been killed, all been poached, none left. So let's go there, let's add some water to the calabash from that secretive place. And when we're there, I'll tell you how we're bringing the rhinos back. And so each little filling of the calabash has its own story. Like another place in Garamba in the Eastern Congo, we were there. I said to the park warden, I said, where would you like to add water from? He said, I'd like to go to the rhino drinking hole, because after all the rhinos have been made extinct here, let's go to where the rhinos have just arrived. We've reintroduced them. Let's go to that waterhole and let's add water symbolically into the calabash. So each calabash filling has a story, and at the end of the journey, we'll empty the calabash, end of the journey. So it's this African symbolism, the talking stick, the calabash, and various other things.
Did you do that on your Cape to Cape trip? Did you take a little bit of water from Cape Agulhas?
Absolutely. And you know, something so small, it's symbolic and it's free.
Yeah.
It doesn't cost you anything. It's all about these little elements to the journey, the talking. Another thing we do, pebbles. You know, we love pebbles.
Yeah.
And we will get to talking about the humanitarian work in a minute. But we just love picking up pebbles, and I'm sure a lot of you listeners would just enjoy it. You get to a lovely place and get a pebble and put it in your pocket.
Yeah.
And this started by years ago, I was writing a book at the time. It was as a tribute to the Africans that had made it possible for the early explorers to achieve what they did. You know, so much tribute goes to David Livingstone, Burton Speke, Livingstone, Stanley, all these great early explorers. But what about the Africans that made it possible?
That actually made it actually happen.
Yeah. So we were doing a book as a tribute to these African guys who made these journeys possible. And as I say, dedicating the book to them, particularly Chuma and Susi, the two guys that had carried it after having
buried. Incredible, incredible story. The dedication.
Yeah, the dedication. And
unbelievable.
And so that, you know, that story. And so there we were. And we were down near Cape Agulhas. And we were right.
What's the name of that book?
So that book is called they're all sold out, but it must be some knocking about.
I'm
but
sure.
It was called Africa and the Footsteps of the Great Explorers.
Okay.
And, you know, when I look back at all those journeys, the role of the calabash filling it at the beginning, empty it at the end, the purpose of doing the humanitarian work as we go, I just, once again, sort of feel so privileged. But getting back to the pebbles, we were down there writing this book near Cape Agulhas, the southernmost tip of Mama Africa, and a friend came to visit, and he said to me, he said, so how come you have the privilege of doing all these journeys? Sure. I looked out to where the two oceans meet, the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic. And there's that beautiful old lighthouse at Agulhas. You've been there. It's beautiful. They say it resembles or is to the same design as the old Pharaoh's lighthouse in Alexandria in Egypt.
Oh, wow.
And when that lighthouse was built, by the way, it was powered by the oil from fat sheep's tails, powering the lamp.
Sure.
And I understand that subscriptions from local farmers help pay for the lighthouse because they were sick and tired of finding the bodies of dead shipwrecks on the beach.
Sure.
Anyway, story of pebbles. The question from Don Pinnock's his name, you might have met him. Great writer, great lover of Africa. How do you get the luck? How come you have had the privilege to do all these journeys? And I saw the light from that lighthouse shining out to sea. And the beach there is covered, as you know, with literally tens of thousands of time-worn pebbles.
Smooth-worn, yeah.
Smooth. So I wandered down to the beach, and I gathered seven pebbles, and I put them on the table, and I said, hey, Don, let's pretend. I said, this is no big religious conviction or anything, but let's pretend that each one of these pebbles is worth 10 summers. 10 summers, summers of life. Let's call them summers rather than years, you know. The beauty of summers, the wind blowing in the palm trees in Zanzibar, and the beauty of summers. I said, how old are you? He said, 54. I said, I'll give you the 4 years free for nothing. So that means your life to date is represented by five pebbles. 50 years. I took those five pebbles and I threw them out to sea. Cape of Needles, where the two oceans meet, the Indian and the Atlantic, and the lighthouse. It's light every now and then shining up out to sea. And I said, do you see, Don, there's only two pebbles left. I said, you know the number of people that I meet that say, when the children are educated, when they finished with their schooling, when we've sold the house, when we've saved enough money, when we've sold the business, when we.
Yeah.
But I said, you know that last pebble, 3 score years and 10,
yeah.
No guarantee. There is actually no guarantee. How fit will you be? How able will you be? You know, so I took that seventh pebble and I threw it out to sea to join the other five, leaving one pebble on the table that evening at Cape Agulhas.
What are you going to do with that?
I said, hey, Don, do you know about life. I said, it's a bit like an old Land Rover. You know, where the windscreen is cracked and where the old side mirrors, you've hit too many trees through the bush and they look like a spider's web of cracked glass. I said, you learned one thing. Concentrate on the road ahead. Don't think back to what you've missed. Think of the road ahead. You've got one pebble. Make sure you make that pebble work, because everything in life is about how you spend your allocated pebble. Anyway, just as a joke, I gave him the pebble. I said, put it in your pocket. I said, it's going to become a damned nuisance. It's going to get caught up with the car keys, come home at night, and then the next morning you have to put this pebble in your pocket and it's going to be sort of rubbed with patina. But I think we need to realize that it's how we spend the pebbles of life. Yes, you need a decent car, you need family, you need a home. I'm not saying you don't need those things. But you also maybe need to remind yourself every now and then about the pebbles of life and the importance thereof. So whenever we end up, we collect pebbles. And there's a lovely Zulu tradition, it's called an isiphivane. It's like a little cairn of stones. And then we make these little cairns. And at the end, we make a can of stones like it, take the calabash water, pour it over, take the scroll of peace and goodwill. And it's another bit of African symbolism. You know? So, yeah, the pebbles of life.
And if I remember, you guys got into a bit of trouble somewhere up in northern Africa because they thought you were either a spy or a South African geologist. Yes. Coming to steal their natural resources. So how did the pebbles get you in trouble on that one?
Well, that was funny because, you know, what would you do if against all odds you made it to the most easterly point of the African continent? Which, if you're looking at a map, you see the Horn of Africa, and you would think that the tip of that horn is the most easterly point. But in fact, you go down about 115 kilometers, and there's a sort of whale tail that pushes out to sea, a little piece of land, and that's the most easterly point. It's called Ras Hafun.
Okay.
Only later did we find that it was, in fact, a Somalian pirate base, but be that what it may. So we needed to go there. And we made it through Sikkinson. We had a little private army, and we traveled mostly at night. And it was one of the, you know, we decided we'd want to also do these sort of key points around Africa. And, and you know, the southerly, easterly, northerly, and this was one of them. So we thought we had to do it. Top of Kilimanjaro, lowest point, Lake of Sol, near Djibouti, all those things. So we thought, well, you know, we need to see that. We got there. And you know, on the top of the Land Rover, we carried a sign in Somali and English. And there was an old Italian lighthouse in the remains thereof, all crumbly, on the most easterly point of the African continent. When the sun rises, it's the first point of Africa that it hits. And we took that old sign calling for peace in Somali and English, and we nailed it up onto this old lighthouse. And we took the little easterly bivouac of stones and we put it there. But of course, we gathered pebbles to bring home.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you do that? And then when we got caught, and sadly we're even introduced to the lad that one that would cut our head off, heads off.
I think you mentioned that you had 10 minutes to convince them why they shouldn't cut your head off.
Because either you're either Al-Shabaab spies or you're illegal geologists. With which Sheila, my partner, quickly ran down to the Land Rover. Those pebbles that we'd picked up from the very easterly point at Ras Hafun, she gathered them up quickly, put them into her underwear. And fortunately, whilst doing so, she found an old book of mine that I'd written years ago called Africa, the Stately.
There we go. That's it right there.
There was my face on the cover, and somehow that persuaded our interrogators to let us breathe another day of life.
Amazing.
And pebbles have different roles to play. So those ones we brought home, and of course this was this crazy collection of pebbles, the calabash, the talking stick, and the scrolls of peace and goodwill, the symbolism that one gives to one's journeys. It's an African thing, I think.
Well, I do believe, but it's also a human story, and because we all came from here, so you know, it's part of what we do. So one of the things that I really wanted, first of all, when did you start growing the beard? Because I have not only hair, but beard envy. So, you know, I'm not worthy.
You know, I suppose it's typical of a young man who finds his freedom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did have quite a sort of strict upbringing.
Yeah.
And my parents suggested that I shouldn't leave South Africa until I turned 21. Sort of rite of passage, gave me the key. You know. So one of the first things I did is had this short, cropped black beard and black curly hair.
Yeah.
And I took off with a rucksack on my back, as was the sort of fashion in those days.
Sure.
You know, we sort of talking about the 60s. And I traveled, I think, 35 countries with, found work wherever I could. And so the beard, you know, got fuller and blacker. And it's just been a way of life. But I have to say that there is a bit of self-interest in this. And you know from your own travels, sometimes you get respect that are beyond your years. You get an amount of respect from people that is actually beyond your years.
Yeah.
And having the big beard and the hat and sitting quietly with your back up against a tree and just nodding and agreeing and slowly talking. The beard in those early days definitely gives you a seniority and respect that you don't necessarily, you don't really necessarily deserve it. But nowadays, of course, you know, at 77, pushing 78 in a few weeks or days' time, as the beard is, becomes one sort of persona. But it's really lovely when you're sitting with Africans and you get greeted as grandfather. And yeah, it gives you a bit of leeway.
Well, that's a wonderful way to frame that. Thank you for sharing the history of the beard, because you know, I do find that you know, even with some facial hair, depending on where you're traveling, it does make it a little easier to kind of flow through a community. You know, whereas if you're clean shaven, you can look a little bit too military or something, you know. So yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, it's all good fun. And sure, you know, so often people come to me and they say, so when are you going to hang up your boots? I get a little offended.
Of course, of course.
You know, I say, what?
And they just said, getting started.
Yeah, you know, 41 expeditions to date.
Yeah.
Surely you've seen it all. I said, never. You'd have to live 10 lifetimes and you'd only begin. And they said, but what is there still to discover? And I'll say, maybe no one's ever stood on the top of that hill. Yeah. Or, you know, you've spent time with that tribe, or you've been lucky enough to be part of a tribal ceremony that is quite unique. So there's always, every journey, there's something more to learn. And then another question that they sometimes ask, so what on your epitaph, is it called epitaph, is that the right? What should that read? Well, I said, hopefully it would be one of those Issy Vivans pebbles, you know, a cairn of stones with a very simple sign that could just read, thank you, Mama Africa.
Yeah.
That would be good enough for me.
Yeah. Because Africa is, it certainly changed me. So I think it's changed most people who've been here. So you have done 40 different expeditions, and one of the ones that I found fascinating when I was reading about your story is you sailed the length, I believe, of Eastern Africa in a dhow. So this is a traditional Arab sailing vessel.
That's right. Yeah, crazy, absolutely crazy. Because none of us were sailors. But we are fascinated by the history of the Swahili coast, the slave trade, the spread of Arab civilization, Phoenician civilization, Indian civilization, Bantu civilization. What made it possible was the trade winds. The Kaskazi and the Kusi, one the northeaster, the other the south wind, that were the engines of trade up the eastern coast of Africa, all the way from Iraq, all the way down to present-day Kenya and Tanzania, Zanzibar, and in Mozambique, the north of Mozambique, Sofala, which was considered the end point of the dhow trade. Trading in kauri shells, ivory, skins, mangrove poles, trading up to the east and bringing back dates and sea chests and jewelry and carpets. We're fascinated by this ancient trade that was driven only by the wind. So what did we do? We found an old dhow. She was an old 35 tonner, 200 square meters of sail. And Bruski, the same guy that I said came on a single adventure and lasted for 15 years, what a delightful character. He found her. And she was up in the mangroves near the Rufiji Delta in Tanzania, in present day Tanzania. And we managed to buy her for a pittance against what you'd pay for a regular yacht.
Sure.
This is an old piece of medieval, you know, maritime history.
Sure.
So we bought her and we sailed her down to Pemba in northern Mozambique. And there were some fundis, which is the Swahili word for tradespeople, craftsmen. We refitted the old girl. She was called Amina, mother of Muhammad, we added the words, the spirit of adventure. And she had the machos, you know, those eyes, those wooden carved eyes on the front to ward off danger. And we replanked her, resealed her with cotton waste and palm nut oil. The outside was first rubbed with shark fat. The ropes were made from old dry coconut fibers. Beautiful. The old cotton sail was stitched up, and we took off. Our aim was to reach the border with Somalia. What a challenge. And we sailed. None of us had ever done something like this before.
Fantastic.
Very limited safety equipment. We'd sleep on deck. There wasn't a toilet, so you had to go off the bank. We'd cook on those little jikos, you know, those little charcoal stoves.
Yeah.
Put a wet sack down so we didn't burn the dhow to pieces in the strong winds. And we sailed her. And every day it just became better and better, a bigger adventure. Sailed her all the way, just short of the Somali border. We had a mutiny.
You did.
Mutiny.
as things go, yeah.
And this happened because we'd hired two outsiders, two Bajuni Arabs, to take us around the back end of some islands where there was an old channel that wasn't on our maps. Beautiful journey between the mangroves. And they'd taken our money, these two scoundrels, and were too afraid to go all the way to the Somali border. So they white anted the rest of the crew. And they turned that crew that had been so faithful to us for so many months, they turned them against us. And it was at a critical part of the journey. So I interviewed each of the crew members one by one. I said to them, do you remember you've traveled with us for 7 months now? Are you going to be a coward? Are you going to listen to us? They said, from what they tell us, we'll never see our families again, ever. There's the Somali Navy that will kill us. They meant the pirates, of course. And of course, there was a chance of that.
Yeah.
Anyway, to a man, they said, we can't carry on any further. Well, we took those two Bajunis who had caused the mutiny, and we gave them the marching orders to walk all the way back to Lamu. And then we said to the crew, okay, you guys hang on here with the dhow, because just us few, three of us, can't sail the dhow. It took 12 people to sail. We can't sail it on our own.
Yeah.
And then we took the inflatable boats. And we continued our journey all to the backwaters and the mangroves, and we got to the border with Somalia. And we even photographed those old navigational markers that still were decorated with old Chinese porcelain.
Incredible.
And whilst in that area, so much suffering, we were able to do right to sight the provision of spectacles to poor sight and malaria work and such like, which we'll talk about in more detail later. And we got back. And on our way back, we stopped and we bought a goat, had it slaughtered, cut up into pieces, put in a bag. My son Ross said, what's that for? I said, you'll see when we get back to the boat. We got back to the boat. And there was all our mutinied crew who couldn't believe we were still alive. Ross took them out on the inflatable boat out into the middle of the lagoon and he said, we've made it, we've survived. What are you going to tell my father? How are you going to explain this to him? Think about it.
Yeah.
They came back on shore, and one by one they came to me and said, we apologize, we weren't brave enough. I said, gentlemen, let's sit around the fire, bring out the goat meat.
Yeah.
And we had a massive celebration. And they sailed with us all the way back to Lamu, back down the east coast, all the way to Safara, the end point of the great dhow days, when dhow journeys were so much part of Africa, and these days you hardly see.
Yeah, it's very rare. I remember in Tanzania seeing, and they're quite big ships, impressive, beautiful.
They're beautiful, and when you're traveling with the wind and you're barreling along and it's just you and the ocean, there's no engine, it's just wonderful. It taught us a lot. living with a small Swahili crew on board,
yeah.
And just going with the wind and the ocean, bare feet on the creaking decks. It was a memorable journey, and there's elements of that journey all over this hostel. We brought the thing back.
Yeah, because you can carry a lot on a ship. You can load it up full of cool stuff.
We brought her back in pieces, and she was an exhibit at a local restaurant here called the Mozambique. And it was beautiful. But when they lifted her to move her to another spot, she broke in two. But when they looked down into the hull, can you believe it? They found a little talisman. A little good luck charm to keep you safe at sea.
Wow.
And it had worked for us.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just the this ocean, the amount of trade.
Oh, up and down.
Yeah.
And what it meant in the spread of civilization. And yeah, to be able to do these journeys is just so lovely. And I said, this one is number 41. And we 2/3 of the way through with it.
And this is for the African Parks.
Yeah, this is working with African Parks, the wonderful work that they do with conservation and with communities. And we believe that there has to be hope for conservation in Africa of our beautiful wild spaces and wild animals. Because if you look around the world, most of it's been lost.
Yes.
And on this continent, there is still hope. Huge, wild, open spaces where these beautiful animals can be preserved, and in so doing, make sure that there are opportunities for the surrounding communities, that for them, it's also their park, and it's their wildlife. And through tourism and all the other benefits, make sure that the communities come out on top. And that's a huge concentration of this journey. Very simply told, it's a journey in search of hope for conservation and communities. Can they coexist? Or should these wildlife areas just be for visiting wealthy tourists moving in and out in open game viewers? No,
I did notice that in Tanzania, which it's not a judgment, but I noticed that it's become so expensive that that's pretty much all you see.
Yeah.
You know, the people of that country don't really have an opportunity to experience it.
And with what we've seen now, how wonderful that is changing. I mean, 5,000 kids a year are brought into Akagera in Rwanda. Mm. Not only into the park to see rhinos and elephants and other wildlife, which is theirs.
Yeah.
But also to go to the community center and learn about fish farming, vegetable growing, poultry, piggeries, you name it. Using this energy around conservation to do good with communities. So we're loving it.
Yeah.
It's a challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, from here, we make our way up through Namibia, through Angola, up through the Democratic Republic of Congo, on through Cameroon, to the Central African Republic. Huge challenges.
Yeah.
And then to Odzala, lowland gorillas, forest elephant, rainforests. And then, of course, finally into the Republic of Chad. Three beautiful parks, one of them called Zakuma, which is like 1950s wildlife. You cannot believe it. The quellias, the bird life, the giraffe, the lions in camp, the elephants, those last of the big mega herds that, of course, have been tortured almost to extermination by rebels. The Janjaweed, the devils on horseback from Darfur, so much in the news these days.
Yeah.
100 horses at a time coming into the park, wiping out the elephants with automatic weapons.
Wow.
And now that's been put to a stop.
Yeah.
The elephants are spreading out from the big mega herd, the matriarchal herds are moving families. And when we last flew over there as part of one of these journeys, there were well over 100 calves that had been bought. They hadn't given birth to a single calf in the last 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
Terrified
stress,
by
yeah.
human beings. So, isn't it lovely that there's always these stories of hope? And this journey is called Africa Odyssey. Community, culture, conservation. Stories of hope.
Yeah.
And I can understand that some people feel this continent is a place of doom and gloom, because if that's what you're looking for, you can find
it. You'll find it, yeah, for sure.
But if you're looking for the good, Wow, I'm disappointed.
Oh, it's overwhelming.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, yeah, I have never had a bad day in Africa.
Oh, that's lovely to hear.
I've had moments that were maybe a little challenging, but yeah, never a bad day, so.
That's lovely to hear. I'm glad that you've so adopted this continent in your adventures.
Well, I just feel such gratitude to have a chance to be here, for sure. So one of the other, I mean, like, literally we could have 100 podcasts, but one of the ones that I found interesting was your Tropic of Capricorn expedition, where you drove around the world on the Tropic of Capricorn. How long ago was that? What were the vehicles that you used?
Yeah, it was it was a long time ago. I'm going to say, let's just say 15 years ago at least, maybe a little more. And we had those old Defender TD5, two standard station wagons, and the big old 130, you know, that long well base. It made such a great expedition vehicle. Lovely. It's just the right sort of power to weight ratio and what you can load and everything. Anyway, we took off on this crazy mission to track the Tropic of Capricorn around the world. Because, you know, the Tropic of Capricorn was so part of the old Super Gondwana land before the continent split.
Pangea.
And I thought, this is still all linked by that Tropic of Capricorn. So off we went. We started on the coast of Mozambique. So it must have been 15 odd years ago, because the landmines were such an issue. You know, here you've got your GPS on the dashboard, 23 degrees 27, and you're following this invisible line. We did a book. It was called Following the Invisible Line. It's crazy, because what are you following? It doesn't exist. But you stick to it, and then you know you get like so determined to follow this line. We gave ourselves the rules. We shouldn't deviate more than 50 kilometers north or south of the line. And we followed it, and we followed it. And I remember in Mozambique those days, there was the danger of landmines. So, you know, you'd have to really be careful, follow cattle tracks, ask people, be careful at old bridges, such like. I remember getting to the Kruger National Park. They called it Tjompe Jaws, to jump to Joburg, because at that time, a lot of illegal immigrants were crossing, you'll remember, from Mozambique across the Kruger National Park to go and work on the gold mines in South Africa. And I remember our guide said, you have to be careful. You're walking across this park. The lions can get you because they've got used to the soft target of human beings. I said, how do you avoid the risk? I said, well, he said, no sex for 7 days.
that was his solution.
And when you get to your first elephant track, having seen a Sangoma, a diviner, a witch doctor, you must make a rope of grass and put it around the first elephant track, and you must step over it gingerly and with respect and chant certain words, and then you won't be killed by lions. I thought, well, that's worth knowing. And so we jumped to Jaws as it was, and I remember we tracked on foot.
Now you were
walking,
and then you were supported by vehicles.
By vehicles. So not always did we walk, but in this case, most of the time it was with the Land Rovers. And I remember walking with this giant of a game ranger. His name was Mabarula, named after a famous chief, size 14 felt schoon boots. And him telling us of how he'd come across a tree where four or five people in that tree had already been dragged down the tree and eaten by a pride of lions. And there was one person left up the tree who'd completely lost his mind, understandably. He said to us, we should be careful. Anyway, we made it across.
So you went from east to west.
And you know that's a bad mistake. Because you're going into the setting sun. What an idiot. I mean, why didn't we go the other way around? Every afternoon, people look at me and they see all the wrinkles and everything. They said, you've had a laugh. And I said, well, we took the wrong direction. Because, you know, like crossing those big deserts of Australia.
Yes.
You're also going up the soft side of the dune instead of the hard side. Yeah. And all the time. And all the time you're squinting into the setting sun. But somehow we made it, you know. We crossed Africa. Oh, you get across the Namib, you know, the oldest desert in the world. You get across the Atacama, you know, the driest desert in the world in South America. And Yeah, the jungle.
Yes, you would have gone through. You would have gone through Bolivia and just
a little bit below Bolivia.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was a fantastic journey, and it of course ended up back where we filled the calabash initially, emptying it at that same spot on the coast of Mozambique 18 months later.
Wow.
A wonderful journey.
Took you over a year and a half to do that.
It was a wonderful journey, and we made it. The vehicles made it, the team made it, and I said to them all, I said, would you ever follow an invisible line again? They said, no. Because it really doesn't exist, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
It's on a map.
Yeah, sure.
But it was a grand adventure. I remember the one time getting to a building, dead on 23 degrees 27. And it was a house of ill repute. So we went into the back door and were thrown out the front by the bouncers. Crazy.
You stayed true to the invisible line.
True to the
without crossing the line.
No, without crossing the line. Yeah, so much humor. And a great journey. And you know, funny enough, you felt that Tropic of Capricorn bound us all together. It was a lovely feeling.
And such an objective to continue to march towards, in a way.
Oh, every day on with the GPS, no roads, through those sand dunes in the western, you know, those deserts of Australia. Yeah, I mean, we went to see the Australian.
They are incredible.
And the Australian authorities said, well, you know, we can't back you on this, mate. Crows are going to peck your arse out. The brown snake's going to get you. I said, so what about the flying doctor? Said, oh, no, where are you going, mate? No flying doctor service going to find you. You're on your own. Anyway, we did it.
Well, yeah, Afrikaners make a plan. Yeah. So I don't really want to touch on vehicles much, but I think it's going to be of interest to the listener is you've mostly used Land Rovers for your journeys. And to great credit to Land Rover, they've been an incredible support to your expeditions. I've had a love for Land Rovers for most of my travels. But recently you've been using these modern, fairly complex Land Rovers, and you were just telling me earlier today that you've really not had any issues with them. So talk about what Land Rover are you using now, and how have they been working for you?
Sure. Well, maybe you should start off by saying green definitely runs in our veins.
Yeah, sure.
And we like the ethos of Land Rovers, those old ones we used to use in the old days, you know, the series ones, twos, threes. I mean, we've used them a lot. And now, of course, here we are in this modern age with the new Defender. And people would say to me, are you going to take those modern-day vehicles that are so technically advanced on your expeditions? I said, well, we're going to try.
Yeah.
Last year, we took three of them from Cape Agulhas, the southernmost point of Africa that we talked about earlier, all the way to the northernmost point that you can drive a vehicle to in the Arctic Circle. So it was called Hot Cape to Cold Cape.
Yeah, sure.
And it was our first experience of these new Defenders. Of course, Ross, my son, who does all the logistics, had a computer with him, a diagnostics computer.
Sure.
And we had one incident, and it turned out just to be a faulty battery. Made it all the way there. We got there, right across Africa, right across Eastern Europe, dodging around Ukraine, Belarus, you know, Latvia, Estonia, Finland, Norway, and then a dash down to Wales, where the first Land Rover was drawn in the sand
right
at Anglesey 75 years before our arrival. And so at low tide, we took our landies out, these modern vehicles out to sea, as it were. And the news got out so quickly, and the Land Rover Club of Anglesey were all there in their old Land Rovers and character vehicles. And that is something about Land Rover, is the solidarity. You know?
Yeah.
And they were all out there.
Sense of community.
Sense of community. And all out there to wish us well. So there you go. That was our first test for these new Defenders. And of course, we really put them through their paces. Standard suspension, everything standard. And we load them to the hilt. Why? Because of all the humanitarian items.
Yeah, sure. How many Mombasa nets do you think you've distributed over the last 30 years?
Well, we've done well over a million malaria prevention nets.
Incredible.
And education to, and we target pregnant mums.
Yeah.
And mums with children under the age of 5.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, I must share that with you that when you get to a village, it's like a thud to the heart, a mother screaming,
yeah.
A child dying, maybe in a coma,
yeah.
Maybe 100 miles or so to the nearest hospital,
yeah.
By dugout canoe. And you realize there's a life that could be saved,
yeah.
By a simple mosquito net and education. So, I mean, I've had malaria countless times. Our whole team suffer. Yeah, we get malaria constantly. It's a way of life in what we do, the areas we camp in,
yeah.
Sleeping under the stars around.
And do you bring the, just to bring it back to something more, a little bit practical, but, because I'm curious, when you get, how do you get a sense that you have malaria, and then do you take the test, the small little swab,
yes.
Test?
We carry the malaria test with us, but the truth be told, we've got so used to identifying the symptoms,
yeah.
That we know.
Yeah.
You know, it's
50 times, right?
Close to about 60. I mean, nothing to be proud of. But you know, the base of your back, you know, you feel you've been hit with a baseball bat. You know, your eyes, when you touch your eyelids, it's sore, the headaches, nauseousness, or the squits, or both.
Yeah.
And you realize I'm going down with malaria. So it's up to every expedition member to carry Coartem, which is the present-day,
yeah.
Drug that you use as,
yeah.
As a cure, in the cubbyhole of the Land Rover, in your personal bag,
yeah.
Hidden in various places. You don't want to run out.
Yeah.
And we treat ourselves instantly. And that's the only reason I'm talking to you today,
yeah.
Is because of quick treatment. Otherwise, we'd be dead.
And how long has that treatment been available?
It's been available for, say, the last probably 10 years at least.
Yeah. What did you do? What did you do before that?
Quinine.
A lot of gin and tonic.
Quinine.
Okay.
Quinine tablets or quinine injection makes your ears ring. You feel nauseous. But that, even today, if the Coartem and the other modern day drugs don't work, last resort, quinine, even today. So yes, the malaria work, and that's just, you know, that's what we didn't like. Should we form an NGO, or maybe we should give out some nets? Maybe we only did this because of our own experiences. We had someone die in the Land Rover. We had malaria so many times. We saw what was happening. We knew that it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So it was a very easy conviction to make. And then one of the other beautiful humanitarian projects or campaigns that we do is one that's so close to our heart because my late wife, Mashozi, started it. And it happened on that journey to circumnavigate the globe on the Tropic of Capricorn. We were in Peru, and we were at a place where the parks authorities had to remove an old man who they felt living alone was a danger to himself, because he couldn't see properly. So we all went there to get an idea. And Mashozi said, all this guy needs is a pair of reading glasses. And she happened to have the correct strength in her bag. Gave it to me, lit a match, he smiled, he was allowed to stay. As we drove out of there, Mashozi turned to me. And that's why the project is still called Mashozi's Right to Sight. She turned to me and she said, Kingsley, I don't care what it takes. If we have to bond our house, whatever we have to sell, it's unacceptable. Just as it's unacceptable that a child dies from malaria, you know, for every minute of the day around the clock in those days. So it's unacceptable that millions of people should have such a low quality of life for something that we take for granted. Go and buy a pair of reading glasses of the right strength.
Sure.
So we learned how to do the tests. We've now done about 250,000 pairs, and it's looking
And you do reading glasses plus vision glasses?
No, just reading glasses. Just reading glasses. So in other words, you can read your Bible again, you can read the Quran, you can do beadwork, you can do craft work, and the difference that makes to someone's life, because we can't carry sophisticated eye testing equipment, but we can carry all the charts and that are necessary for reading glasses. Yeah. It's very easy. And 90% of all eyesight problems in Africa can be solved by a simple pair of readers.
Amazing.
And the difference it makes. You know, you get the right strength, and that person, like I remember an old Maasai woman, she made a living from doing beadwork. A couple of teeth missing, this old duck. And now when she got the right strength glasses, she could pick up the red bead, the blue bead, the green bead, and she could see again, and she got a quality of life back again, and she could make a living. Mm-hmm. And the little community around her all clapped their hands and cheered. She'd got her life back for the simple pair of reading glasses. I remember one other guy, he came in, we were out in the Tugan Hills in the Great Rift Valley in Kenya. And we were on the veranda of an old trading store, and this old codger came up, one leg, homemade crutch. I said, "What happened to you?" He said, "I got ridden over by a tractor and I couldn't farm anymore." I said, "And then what did you do?" He said, "I learned to become a cobbler, fixed the shoes for the community." And I said, "And then?" He said, "I can't see the thread anymore. I can't see the needle. I can't thread the needle." So I remember the strength he took even. It was a 2.75. And I remember even giving him a 3. I said, "He has a 2.75. They have lovely little bags. We put them in so they don't scratch. And he has a 3 for a few years' time." And he shouted to his grandson, "Bring me my equipment." His grandson came running over with a little anvil and a half-finished shoe. The thread was still there, the tools, and straight away he got back to being the cobbler for the community. The crowd roared, "Yay, they got their cobbler back." He got his life back for a simple pair of reading glasses that we so take for granted. So it's a lovely project.
For those that are listening, how do they help support what you're doing, for example, with the glasses? Do they go to the kingsleyholgay.com, or how do they support what you're doing with the glasses?
What's happening at the moment is that the malaria work is supported by Land Rover, and we have to fund the right to sight work, Lumashwazi's right to sight work, and it's an area that we really do need help. So if anyone wanted to support that, just with a few dollars go a long way, then you could just get hold of the Kingsley Holgate Foundation and we could lead you through how easy it is. And really, just, you know, a few $100 goes a long way.
Yeah, I would expect that would buy dozens of glasses. Yeah.
Yes, and so it's the glasses. Of course, it's the work in getting them out there.
Of course,
And then lovely little soft drawstring bags to keep each pair safe for the recipient. But it's a lovely project because the instant gratification is just so lovely. It's so good for the soul.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, we've had a rough day and we're sitting around the campfire and I'll say to the team, "Was it worth it, guys?" You know, if you do 150 recipients in a day with the Right to Sight project, it's a full day.
Yeah.
And, you know, you try and work out the person's age. Many of them don't know, so it might be related to a historic occasion.
Yeah.
And then you take the person's age, you deduct 35, and you divide the result by 10, and that's your starting eye strength. Mm. And just that can be 10 minutes. And then you chat to them and what can't you do and what you can do. And then you get it right. And wow, that instant gratification when that person can see again. It's just lovely. So when you're sitting around the fire after a hard day and you say to the team, "Is this worth it, guys? It's a lot of work." They say, "You know, if you stop the humanitarian work, you'd remove the soul from the expedition."
Well, and it's actually what makes it an expedition to begin with. I mean, people use that word far too lightly. You know, if you're not contributing something significant on the humanitarian front, or if you're not doing scientific support and research, or doing something that is so maybe the first of something, it's really not an expedition.
Yes, you're right.
A bit of marketing is all it is.
You're so right. So yes, it's the right to start. And then another little program that we love so much, and it's just had its 10th anniversary, was we've been shocked by the increase in the number of rhinos that are being killed across Africa. You know, exterminated for their horns, sold to Southeast Asia for a purpose that doesn't work. They're not medicine.
But it's the same thing that our nails are made of.
Silly. So now they bling, you know, someone will have one up in the mantelpiece and, you know, all that. And so we just felt, what can we do as an ordinary bunch of adventurers? What can we do? And we decided, let's work with the children, the next generation. And so we did a journey, and we started this campaign called Rhino Art. A simple H3 piece of paper, the outline of a rhino. The title on the page was in Zulu, in the Zulu language. And it said, Siyabathanda Upecha, which means, we love our rhinos. And underneath we had English, let our voices be heard.
Yeah.
And we took this to thousands of children. They would do the chant, Siyabathanda Upecha, let our voices be heard. And then they would color in the rhinos, very often with a national flag of the country, Swaziland, South Africa, Botswana, Zambia, Zimbabwe. And as importantly, they would, around the rhino, they would put other animals, the trees, the rivers, the landscape where they lived, village scenes. And then at the bottom, they'd fill in their name, their grade, the name of the school, the country, the province, everything. But most importantly, there would be a space, or is a space, where they write the message, their message of how they feel, wanting their voices to be heard for the future of these animals. And wow, we've featured more than 500,000 kids. It's just wonderful. And on the journey we're on now, all 22 parks across 12 countries of Africa, at every one of them we do wildlife art. And of course, when you come to the prize giving, to the judging event, that's a football game. Man of the match wins a bicycle. The rhinos against the elephants. And you know that whole thing of keeping it fun.
Yeah, sure.
And it's just a wonderful program. So yes, the malaria work, the right to sight, and community conservation art with a purpose.
I remember the first time that I saw a rhino, it was in South Africa, and we came around a corner, and this rhino was, you know, maybe three quarters to us in the road. And it took up the entire road. And I remember it took me several moments for my brain to register how massive this animal was and how impressive it was. I mean, an elephant is, of course, much larger, but I wasn't expecting to see a rhino because they're so rare. And then to actually see one with your own eyes, it was nearly a spiritual experience.
Yeah, this wonderful creature that goes back to the time of the dinosaurs.
Yeah, it feels
and,
like.
And why do we have human beings that want to wipe it off the face of the earth? Corruption and greed and wealth. But so the little bits that we can do, and you know, I'm so pleased to see that on this journey that there's so much hope. You know, in some areas where the rhinos have been slaughtered, become extinct, and now in other areas they're coming up and being reintroduced and having their calves. So the overall picture is there's always hope for Africa.
Yeah, what an incredible and diverse continent, for sure. So what are, when you do your trips, what's been two or three constants throughout these journeys? The little pieces of kit, or the one gadget that you like to bring along on all these journeys? What are some of the things that you found works for you in your travels?
Well, it all starts with a paper map. So we go to the architect's office and run off a big map of Africa, just showing the countries, no roads or rivers or anything else. And we come into this room behind us here, it's called the Swahili Shed. And we put out this big map on the table, and the team all gather around, and we discuss the journey. And we write, this area needs malaria support. That area needs support for right to sight. Here we need to do community conservation work. Here is some real challenges, 4x4 roads, mountain crossings, river crossings, interesting tribes. And then on that paper map gets all these scribbles. It's such a nice way of starting a journey.
I would say so.
And then you roll up that map and you fly to Land Rover's head office, and you put it out on the table, and you say, how's this for a journey? By that time, you've given the journey a name, you've given it a clear objective, you've said how long it will last, roughly, and you say, so what do you think, team? They say, it's fantastic. You hand them one of those felt-tip pens, and you say, sign it. Roll it up, and the adventure starts. And we still do that to this day. Isn't that lovely? So as opposed to 27 emails, out comes the old paper map. Yeah, it's just a lovely.
Well, and people can relate to
it. Yeah, and make a copy and put it in your boardroom.
Yeah.
Or put it in your home, you know, put it up. So there's that symbolic start to each journey is when you finish the paper map. And that really symbolizes the start of the journey. And then, as always, a logo, a vision, and a mission. What do you want to achieve? It's so important that we get that right. So everybody in the team knows exactly whatever might go wrong or badly or up and down, the mission for the journey remains very, very strong and the objective. So that's sort of fairly obvious. And we have one of the team as a bit of an art director, and he designs the logos and everything, and they're always quite lovely. And then we take off, and you asked about those sort of important bits of kit. Well, one thing that we have learned is that we all, and I'm sure you do as well, Scott, we load too much stuff.
It's taken me a long time to learn.
The trick is to limit it to one soft bag. It's the same people that do our beautiful scrolls of peace in Goodwill, Melville, and Moon. One bag each. Chuck your stuff in there. Remembering that these days, as you travel Africa, you can go to those second-hand clothes markets. Most of those clothes, I understand, are imported from America. And you can buy a really good brand shirt.
If you need one, yeah.
Yeah, and you can just wear that. You know, you don't have to. You don't have to carry enormous amounts. So that's just one lesson that you do need to carry a good medical kit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And your comms should be the best that you can. Of course, nowadays you've got this new satellite system,
Starlink. Yeah.
We tried it out in Tanzania, and it really is quite impressive. Now, of course, some countries, as you know, don't like you to have a satellite phone.
Yes, that's right. So, for example, I can't take Starlink into Ethiopia. So.
Oh no.
Yeah.
No. So good comms are good, and there's that old thing that is let people know at home where you are and where you're heading for. It is a lovely feeling when you sit around and you say to yourself, do you know, there's not another person in the world that knows where the hell we are. And that's a nice feeling, isn't
it? Yeah, that's right.
But I think for security reasons, you need to let people know where you are, where you're traveling to, have those good comms, good medical kit, good comms. Now let's get on to that and limit the amount of personal kit that you carry.
Yeah.
But let's get to the most important subject, I guess, is food. And
South Africans do like good food.
And what I share with people is that you can buy everything in Africa. You can go to the local market.
Land of plenty.
It's not like, you know, it won't be a fancy supermarket necessarily, but you can go to the market, and like in Zambia, and they shout to you, hello, customer. And you can get these little red tomatoes that aren't full of fertilizer, organically grown naturally. And isn't it lovely? And then you support the local people, and you have your old basket that hangs from the back of the Land Rover so the air can pass through it, and you've got your potatoes and your onions and your tomatoes. And you know, you can buy meat from the local market. It just means you have to hang it a bit and cook it better. But you can get stuff all across Africa. So I don't think travelers should get hung up on that you have to carry an entire supermarket with you. So that's those two. And then, of course, the old obvious ones, you know, pieces of kit, a decent camera, binoculars, your notebook, pencil, medical kit, the calabash.
And the pebbles.
The pebbles, the scroll of peace and goodwill, and the old talking stick.
You don't need much. You don't need much.
And you know, people often talk about border crossings. And I suppose we've been doing it so much that we just trust a fixer.
Yeah.
We meet a guy, he's got a nice face. Will you take us through the process, agree on a price? He takes your passport, you do what you have to do. And try and avoid that typical sort of Westerner anxiety. Oh, border control, entitlement, they're going to rip us off, it's going to be a terrible experience. It's not, just smile and wave a lot.
Yeah, you signed up for an adventure, didn't you?
And of course, not only the things that you should carry with you, like a good medical kit. What is quite nice is to carry a small box that can be called the condiments box.
Okay.
So your favorite Nando's sauce, like in South Africa, Marmite or Bovril, those little luxuries, have that little box that you can easily carry. So when you go into a little simple rural restaurant to buy donuts and coffee or whatever, you know, Maasai tea and mandazis, you know.
Yeah, those are good.
Aren't they? But then you've got your little box with the peanut butter and the right sauces. And so they never mind. No one ever objects to it.
Yeah, sure.
And so you spark up your meal a little bit and make it a bit more fancy.
Yeah.
So everything's possible with the right attitude. A lot of youngsters, Scott, come to me and say, how can we possibly adventure? I say, you don't have to have the fanciest of vehicles. You just have to have the attitude, a mission, a vision, a name, know exactly what you want to do. But the most important thing you have to do is turn the key.
Yeah.
Turn the key and you'll be absolutely surprised at what you can do. You turn the key and you're going and you look back and think, did I get this together? It was the moment that you stopped talking about it and turned the key.
Yeah.
And that turning the key, that moment you turn the key and you head off, that's that symbolic moment. Yeah, that starts a new adventure.
Otherwise, you keep spending pebbles, and you don't end up with very many left by the time you turn the key.
Yeah, and you talk about it, and your mates all say, so when you're leaving, that's another thing, give it a date.
Yeah.
Even if it's an arbitrary date, say on the 28th of February, next year we are leaving to do this.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised at the energy that gathers. Mm-hmm. It's amazing, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, I'm sure you've done that a number of times. You're not sure when you're leaving, but you say, I'm going to leave on that date. And there's this sort of unseen energy that gathers and pushes you along.
It's wonderful. It is, and it's necessary to put that line in the sand.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I love to ask, and it's a bit selfish because of my love of reading, but obviously you've written a lot of books yourself, Kingsley, but do you have a few books that you love that were written by someone else?
Oh, lots.
Your library is one that I'm jealous of many things, including the beard. But your library, I think, is pretty high on my list of the things.
We had an old house up in Zululand, busy moving to another property, and it's got an Africana library. But it's not necessarily these ancient, very expensive books about the early explorers. I've made it a habit to, wherever possible, buy anything on African adventure and travel. Yeah. Travel and adventure. It could be a 1950s AA book to Northern Rhodesia. Doesn't matter, I just buy it.
You like it?
Yeah, and the library is such that it even needs a ladder.
That's a proper library.
And you sort of suss out your mood. It's a bit of a rainy Sunday. What would I like? I think The White Nile. Let's get the book on The White Nile. That's a fantastic book. You go up the ladder and you grab The White Nile. You sit in your favorite chair, getting enough light through the window, and you immerse yourself in another great adventure. White Nile, I think, is by Moorhead.
Okay.
Is the author. Beautiful book. But, yeah, sir. But in terms of what do you carry on the adventure, space is a problem because books are heavy.
Yeah.
But still, we do it. Great reference books. Michael Mayne's book on the Zambezi River. Mm. Zambezi Odyssey was another one. But so many great books, and we take those along with us as reference books, together, of course, with guidebooks and paper maps. Now, that's something quite heavy to take. Yeah. A lot of people might not do that. Rather just Google Rwanda.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, we've still got this old habit of pulling out a guidebook. There's something about that, isn't there? Following the pages. But
well, because it can present something to you that maybe you wouldn't search for.
Yes.
And so I do find that guidebooks oftentimes, for me, help me find something new.
Yes.
unexpected.
So, I mean, you had a few scattered around. Yeah, there are. Is Rwanda,
and these are, for those that are Zambia. Watching, these were on the table to begin with.
Yes.
You didn't add them.
No. So, and some of them are quite old, you know. So you'll be going off to a country and you've got a 10-year-old guidebook. Yeah. Or but it still gives you the basic knowledge. You know?
So Kingsley, in this incredible life that you've lived, and of course you have many adventures still to come, but what is one of the things that you've done that you're most proud of?
One that I think changed our lives was when South Africa came of age and we had our first democratic elections. And we took off on this journey, which is called Africa Odyssey, but it simply got called in the books here. It got called Cape to Cairo. I don't know why. Yeah. Everybody just, Cape to Cairo. And using open boats along the rivers and lakes of Africa, we traveled the entire continent. And you know, getting to Ethiopia, for example, and over the radio, coming the news, South Africa is a democracy. And then them allowing us in. So you had this feeling that you were sort of an unofficial diplomat or ambassador for the new order. And I've always just find it incredible how Africa can forgive and how welcome people made us. So that journey in 1992-93 to cross Africa from the Cape of Good Hope all the way to the mouth of the Nile in open boats, I think we'll remember it forever, because it was as if in our lives we again became citizens of Mama Africa.
Yeah.
Citizens of the greater continent. And I remember arriving in Cairo, and South Africa at that point had only been a trade consulate or something, trade mission. But now, with the arrival of democracy, and our journey was a full-on embassy. And a number of the other embassies all joined us. They brought red wine and roast beef and what have you from South Africa was flown in, and we had this wonderful get-together, incredible function. It was like, wow, we're part of the new South Africa. We're part again of the greater Africa. And so that journey always sticks in our mind. And funny enough, on the way back, bringing all the equipment down, Ross and a mate of his brought the boats and the vehicles down all the way back through to Nairobi. And we got through to Nairobi, said we're not ready for home yet. And we started a safari business called Africa Odyssey and spent many years in East Africa. But that was started by this journey from Cape Town to Cairo and Alexandria in open boats. And it was this time in one's life where you felt, wow, I'm a member of this greater continent.
And a member of humanity, because this is, Africa's story is a human story. Kingsley, how do people find out more about what you do?
Well, fortunately, Sheila, my partner, she's good at keeping records. So she takes my scribbles from the notebook and she turns them into great Facebook stories. So if anyone interested were to follow us on Facebook, the Kingsley Holgate Foundation, you'd be instantly part of our journeys. And what you'd be doing for us, there's this feeling of solidarity that we're not traveling alone. We don't buy posts. We don't, you know, it just is who we are and what we do.
Sure.
It's stories from the heart. And if you were to follow those, you'd get a good idea of how the journeys roll, the humanitarian work and all the other good stuff. And so, yeah, just go onto the Kingsley Holgate Foundation, go onto the website, you'd get to know more about us. And in talking to you, Scott, wouldn't it be wonderful if some of your followers and some of your readers could maybe get involved in that Right to Sound campaign?
I would love that. And we're going to provide information in the show notes of the podcast so that people can reach out and connect with you further and find ways to give back. Kingsley, it has been all of the honor that I expected to spend this time with you. You're an inspiration to me. You're an inspiration to so many throughout Africa and the world because of your journeys. Your humility and your awareness about the importance of giving back is such a lesson to all of us. I'm grateful, and I thank you for spending the time with me today.
Thank you, Scott. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, my friend. Pleasure. Thank you. We thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.